Okay, so for those of you who are just joining us, we're doing something that we haven't done before. We're actually going to go to the Bible today. No, it's not bad. I've been working on writing up some of the 7 questions that people ask about Christianity. And I've been working on the concept of truth. And I thought it would be appropriate to get some input and feedback. Oops. Are there any other outlines? Get a little feedback on this. So I'm really interested in doing Roman numeral 1 today. If we get to any of the other stuff, that's all well and good. But my major concern is to help you understand and get your understanding of the concept of truth. The stuff down below in terms of how truth works in a Christian life is almost a second subject, but I figured since we're doing church, it might be good to talk about that for a bit. So one of the most fundamental questions that we have to ask is, how do we know what's true? You know, you believe that Jesus is the creator God. Somebody else believes that it's Brahma, or that it's Allah, or that the universe just popped into being. How do you know that your belief is true? Does belief cause something to be true? If you believe in magic carpets, do they just start suddenly flying around the room? Belief doesn't create reality. For a lot of people, their beliefs are just concepts that they've gathered as they've walked through life. It's kind of like they're wearing a backpack, and they come across an idea, and they say, oh, that's interesting, and they put it in their backpack. And they come across another one, and oh, that's interesting, and they pop it in their backpack, and oh, I never heard that one before, I'll take that one. And they gather this conglomeration of concepts. And then when they need to kind of make a decision or something, they kind of reach into the backpack, whatever they happen to find here, they pull out and say, oh, well, yeah, maybe it fits, maybe it doesn't. And if it doesn't work, they'll go for another one. And they kind of go through life with this conglomeration of concepts that are neither consistent nor logical nor reasonable. And they kind of wind up basing their life on a fairy tale. And if you base your life on things that are not real, you wind up being disappointed. There are other people that kind of have done a little work and they've reached conclusions. Their ideas about reality are conclusions. They've looked at some data, they've analyzed it, and they said, yeah, that makes sense, and they've kind of gone with what is reasonable to them. And that's pretty good. And you rarely run into folks that do that, where they've actually come up with conclusions about life. Of course, in debate circles, you run into these people a little more frequently because that's what they get trained to do. But it's relatively rare to find someone who actually has come up with some conclusions about life. And the conclusions have to be based on facts. And then the critter that you never run into is someone who's got convictions that are based on facts. You run into a lot of people who have convictions. They're convicted and believe in what they believe. But it isn't a result of any conclusions that they first reached. And the idea behind a conviction is that you've done the study, you've figured out a conclusion, and then you've considered ways of falsifying it. Is there any way this could be untrue? Is there information that I don't know about that could somehow overturn this? And then what's the likelihood of that happening? And I'll return to this concept of convictions a little later at the end. But I want to first start you thinking about, how do you know that what you believe is true? I remember I had a conversation with my dad a couple years before he accepted Christ and then shortly thereafter died. And he was raised in the Catholic schools. And I asked him where he got his beliefs from. And he said, when they gave us the math book, we didn't ask where the math book come from. When they gave us the geography book, we didn't ask where the geography book came from. And when they gave us the religion book, we didn't ask where the religion book came from. It's just like the tradition that just gets passed on. Well, what happens when you have two conflicting traditions? Can they both be true? How do you know which is right? How do you know that your beliefs are right? And eventually you found out about Jesus and the need to accept him and is now living happily ever after in heaven. Tradition, you know, it's good, but not necessarily the determinant of ultimate truth. There are some people who say you cannot know ultimate truth. And we're going to address them in a couple minutes. But if I started out with that, Jill said I'd totally lose you. So I'm planning on losing you in C. So, you know, pay attention for A and B because that's probably all you'll get. There's a reason for that. 25% of the population are big picture thinkers, and I'm going to be talking about some big picture concepts. And of that 25%, less than half of them are actually thinkers. They actually think about it. So like only 10% of you might get this. But in case you run across someone in the future who has these things, and you want to be able to love them with truth, you kind of want to put the extra effort to understand this. It does actually make sense. So people are going to say it's unknown. Some say you can't know it. Some say it's relative. So I leave my relatives out of this. And some say it's irrelevant. It doesn't make any difference. And those are the believers I'm talking about. Unbelievers say the same thing, but I've encountered believers that have these same attitudes towards truth. Who knows? Nobody can know. It's all a big mystery. It's a leap in the dark, as opposed to a step in the light. So, people think, if you're really sincere about what you believe, it makes it true. So, if you're really sincere clapping for Tinkerbell to come back to life, does your clapping make her come back to life? There's so many things wrong with this thing because Tinkerbell is a fairy tale as well. But being sincere, you can be sincerely wrong. People set themselves on fire to make their point. But that doesn't make their point. It doesn't create the reality. Majority opinion. When I teach my Western Civ class, I normally get to this point in the class around Columbus Day. So I talk about Columbus's four ships, the Nina, the Pinta, the Santa Maria, and the one that fell off the edge of the earth. And most of my students don't get it. But the majority of people used to believe the world was flat. Did that make it flat? No, there's an ultimate reality out there, and they were basically growing in their understanding of that reality. So even if everybody, 98% of the population believes something, that could mean that 98% of the population is wrong. In fact, a little later, we might talk about the fact that truth is narrow, and by and large, people are going to miss it. How about experience? If you're a child of your culture, which you are, right now, experience is king. If you can experience something, it's real, baby, and if you can't, it's not. But does experience determine truth? I do this thing in my classes where, because I have criminal justice students in the class, and they told me this story, and it gets repeated every semester, where a prof will have the criminal justice class, and as he's talking, the door bursts open, and two guys come in fighting, and they're swinging at each other, and who knows what else is going on, and the prof rushes over and herds them out the door and slams the door, and he turns around to the class and says, "Okay, take out a piece of paper and write down everything you saw." And he gets 30 different accounts of what happened. Everybody experienced the same thing, yet their perceptual filters made them see it differently. The way they process things made them see it differently. And yeah, there would be some overlap and some of them agreed, but just because you experience something doesn't mean you're accurately understanding or accurately interpreting it. I remember one of my first Bible studies down on Wall Street, I was talking with a guy who said, "I was driving through the wilds of Pennsylvania, and I looked at my gas gauge and it was on empty, and I knew if I ran out of gas there, I'd be lost forever. So I prayed to the Virgin Mary that I would not run out of gas, and I didn't run out of gas." So I said, "Granted, that's what happened." And then he said, "Well, it could have been some other reason." It's perception of the reality, and the perceptions are faulty, and just experiencing something doesn't make it right. Roman numeral 1b is my point on this. We let our experiences in this world form our understanding of the truth, instead of letting the truth form our understanding of this world. Because belief, sincerity, tradition, majority opinion, experience, all can be right, but they're incorrect determiners of the truth. By truth, I mean that which is kind of like universally valid, accurate reflection of reality. To say that something is true means that, yeah, it conforms to reality at a certain point in time. Like if you park in front of City Hall, you get a ticket. That's true. Unless you park there after midnight, then you don't get a ticket. So while it's true, it's not a truth. So when we use the word truth, I'm talking about something that is always true across time and across reality. So I want to deal with something that's really frequent in our culture, where someone says, oh, that's nice that you found that. That's true for you, but it's not true for me. You ever heard that one? No, it's, and that's basically saying truth is relative. Truth is what you make it. If you run into someone who has been infected by philosophy, they'll have another take on this argument, which basically says, oh, you can't know true. You can't know truth. There are no absolutes. So I want to deal with how you respond to these kind of questions to move them to an understanding of the truth. I found through the years that further down the road as a person develops their relationship with God, if this issue isn't nailed down, they won't progress and grow. Because truth is fundamental to having a relationship with God, and if you misunderstand it, you miss out on many aspects of your relationship with God. So let's try to deal with it. Let's see if I wrote something out. To say that truth is unknown, or unknowable, or relative, is to make a impossible, knowledgeable, absolute truth statement about the truth, and I just lost everybody. Okay, so let's break it down a little bit more. Paul, in Acts 26:25, was making his defense before Agrippa or somebody, and he said, I'm not mad. I speak words of truth and reason. And these are things that we tend not to focus on because our experiential culture is just truth is whatever you want. It's, you know, this reason doesn't have to enter into the equation. If you understand what postmodernism is, it's like reason is no good, it's just whatever you experience. In fact, you won't be able to experience life until you turn off reason. Paul spoke words of reason and truth. Jesus is truth. Truth is reasonable. So we're going to look at this a little bit more. Let's deal with the easy one. There are no absolutes. What's wrong with that statement? It's an absolute statement. Now, and that's what's called a self-defeating proposition. I'll go a little slower. You missed that one. But everybody got that one? To say that there are no absolutes, ever, is to make an absolute statement. And one of the basic fundamental ideas in humanity is contradictions are not that good. You know, it can't be black and white at the same time. I used to teach a worldview class for young uns, and in order to get them to show up, I used to bring donuts. So, that's why they would show up. So, I actually wanted to teach them the one verse of evangelism that was ever done on me, which was something along these lines. A modified peanut butter and jelly sandwich is not a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Some of you know the story behind this, but it's incredible truth. If you meditate on it enough, you figure out the universe. But it goes like this. I would take the donuts in the class, and I would cut two slices out of them. And I bought a little jar of peanut butter and a little jar of jelly, and I would spread peanut butter on one piece of donut and jelly on the other piece of donut, and I would smush it together in a sandwich, and I would say, behold, the peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And some kids would say, that's not a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And some would say, it was. And some would just eat the thing. So, was it a peanut butter and jelly sandwich or not? Well, that depends on how you define your terms. If I took a frog and put peanut butter on them, and I took another frog and put jelly on them, and I smushed the two of them together, would I have a peanut butter and jelly sandwich? Well, you bought the donut maybe, you know, because donuts are bread stuff, but what about the frogs? You know, as long as they don't hop away, you actually do have something sandwiched between the two of them there, or it's a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Well, that's no fun. We like them fresh. So, how about if I took two pieces of steel and I put peanut butter in one and jelly in the other and smushed them together? Would I have a peanut butter and jelly sandwich? All right, let's go back to bread or donuts. If I put peanut butter on one and fluff on the other, smushed them together, what do I have? A peanut butter and fluff sandwich. It's a modified peanut butter and jelly sandwich, but it's not a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. It's a modified one. And the conversation that kind of changed my life is when someone said, are you a Christian? And I said, yes, but I don't believe all that stuff that Christians believe. I'm a modified Christian. And she said, well, it's kind of like we were sitting in the kitchen at the time. And she said, it's kind of like a modified peanut butter and jelly sandwich. It's not a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. It either is or it isn't. And she was really using Aristotle's laws of logic on me. And I didn't recognize it at the time. But Aristotle posited or said there are three kind of ideas that we need in order to be able to communicate or have in common an idea. Communication, have in common. And you all have come up at some point in a conversation where you realize, oh, you need to define their terms. Like, if you say God, we think of the creator, sustainer of the universe, the one who sent Jesus to die for our sins. But they might be thinking of the force and power within them, or the God of this world, or, you know, who knows what. So you need to come to an understanding. And Aristotle's first law of logic is not that difficult. It's called the law of identity. You math whizzes, it's A equals A. If I'm talking about A, it's A. That's the way the two things work. If you need an understanding of this, talk to Tom later, and I'm sure he'll confuse you on a much higher level. But that's the basic law of identity. And then we got the peanut butter and jelly sandwich one. It's the law of non-contradiction. It basically says that A cannot equal non-A. It's like an apple and an orange. An apple's an apple. An apple is not an orange. What if it's an or apple? Something in between? His third law says you can't do that. It's called the law of the excluded middle. It's either got to be A or non-A. It's either got to be a peanut butter and jelly sandwich or a peanut butter and fluff sandwich or peanut butter and banana. What's that, a nutter butter? Or peanut butter and Nutella sandwich. Ooh, how about a Nutella and jelly sandwich? Oh, should be doing this before lunch. So it's one or the other. When we talk about God, some people say, well, God is many. Some people say God is one. God is everything. God is nothing. We can't be talking about the same thing. We need to start understanding that there's a logic behind it. So these are going to come into play when we get a little further down the road, but I want to pick up the relative part. How about that's true for you? This is called relativism. Right, now this is a little tricky, so if you don't get it, listen to the tape and talk to Tom. Relativism basically says truth is whatever you want it to be. Right? So it's relative. You want truth to be one thing, I want truth to be the other thing. We make our own reality. Truth is whatever you want. Okay, so here's the proposition. My truth, the thing that's true to me, is that relativism is false. That's truth, and that's what I believe. I believe that truth is not relative, and that relativism is false. That's truth for me. So if whatever I want to be true is true, I've made the case that relativism is false. If the person, you debate people to double blind, if they say, no, you can't do that. But why not? You just told me I could. You just told me truth could be whatever I wanted. So I made relativism false. Ergo, it's false. So on both these things, on absolute truth and relativism, the world is wired and created in such a way that you can't make these statements. You can't say there are no absolutes, but you can say there are. You can't say that truth is relative, but you can say that it isn't. And the basic meaning by which we communicate something determines how we progress in the conversation. So I made this distinction earlier between true and truth. And I said that truth is absolute, it's universal, it transcends time, and it transcends culture. So let's think about this. Does it make any difference what happens to you after you die if you're born in Asia 2000 BC or Africa 2000 AD? Does time or culture affect how a baby is born, maybe the conditions under which they're born, and does it affect what happens to you after you die? And if your answer is no, it should be kind of a universal experience, you have hit upon a absolute truth. It's something that's universally true. Now how can I, as a finite being, know infinite truth? If I kind of take my little data points and I try to draw a curve, I do this on a board in class, and I start, get a couple data points, I have my little guy in his perspective, and he can't see too far out, he can only see a certain portion of the graph, and he tries to draw a line and says, okay, that's truth. And I say, well, what happens when you go further out? And I have some kids drawing a hyperbole where it goes down, others go up. And then I say, well, could it be this? And I draw a sine wave. You really can't know what's outside your experience. Let's pretend this room is life. We live in this room. All of our existence and being takes place in this room. And we notice that every once in a while, we have a little door over there, it opens up and a baby gets thrown in. And they kind of live and grow and, you know, do their thing here in the room. And then as they start getting older, they go to the window and they kind of jump out, and we can't see what's beyond the window. That's life. Baby comes in, old guy jumps out. All right, that's it. And don't get any ideas. Keep them away from the window. And that's life. The whole thing is contained in these four walls and ceiling and floor. Now, inquiring minds are going to start thinking, what's on the other side of the door? Or what happens outside the window? Besides hands go splat. What goes on out there? We're never going to be able to figure it out because our understanding is limited by the things that we can sense and experience in these four walls. Does that mean that truth is only something you can sense? Does that mean that truth is only material? And if you can't taste it, see it, smell it, touch it, again, well, feel, touch, hear it, yeah, thanks, then it doesn't exist? Well, what about a word, a sentence, a paragraph, a concept, a book? Is that material or immaterial? Well, book, obviously, but what about the stuff in the book? If you dissect a cadaver, can you find a word somewhere in that cranium? Oh, look, we found a sentence. No, it doesn't exist in the physical realm. It exists in the immaterial realm. They're immaterial things. So I ask my class, is the universe material or immaterial? And eventually some people get the idea, oh, it's both. And if you understand E equals MC squared, talk to Philip about this one, or Garrett, you realize that there's a correlation between the two. And it's more reasonable almost to think that our world is energy than it is material, because material goes back to energy, according to Einstein. And in that material, immaterial world, while we're on it, is everything good? Is everything that happens in the spirit realm good? No, there's positive and negative stuff as well. So how am I, bound in this room by time and space, ever going to know what happens on the other side? The next one in this series is there a supernatural being and can he walk and talk? Is there any evidence that there is a supernatural being throughout history where he's acted and communicated, taught? But that gets beyond me. But I build the case for there being a supernatural being in Roman numeral 1D. The only way I, as a finite being, can know infinite truth, and in my classes I say, if there is such a thing, is if an infinite being reveals it to them or me. I'm only going to know what happens on the other side of that window or on the other side of that wall if someone comes from there and tells me. It's the only way I'm going to find out. Because as far as we know, there haven't been a whole lot of people that have gone there and come back. But there is some evidence in history that such a thing has occurred. And it'd be worth exploring that. So what kind of proof do you want that there was this being that actually did these things? And some people say, well, I want scientific proof. All right, so you want something that's observable and repeatable in a controlled environment. Right? That's what science is all about. You observe it, see it happens, and I drop my book. You know, there, okay, I dropped my water bottle there, see it, dropped it, drop, drop, drop. Okay, every time I let it go, it progresses towards the music stand and hits it. Right, there's no mirrors, there's no, you know, nothing else. It's like, so you say there's something that causes this thing to go down rather than up, and you start developing a theory of gravity. By the way, has anybody ever seen gravity? Oh man, yeah, you can observe the effects of it, but you can't actually see it. Ah, look, there's a gravity. Look at my gravity collection. Gone all over the world to collect gravity, and there it is on the wall. In fact, it would look just like that. So scientific method is kind of a inadequate means of determining what actually occurred in history. In fact, well, I'll get to this in the future. Let's look at legal historical evidence, stuff that holds up in a court of law, things beyond a reasonable doubt. And my whole premise is, what's more reasonable? Yeah, there's lots of different approaches and explanations for the universe and the world, but what's the most reasonable one, the more reasonable one to take? And that creates a dialogue. Well, you know, let me see what your explanation is, and I'll bring my explanation, and let's take a look at them. For there to be legal historical proof, you have things like eyewitnesses, you have evidence, the smoking gun, the bullet matches the one found in their brain, the fingerprints match the ones on their fingers. And then you apply reason to the evidence. Actually, in the scientific method, you get data and you apply reason to the data and come up with hypotheses. And this is how we basically form our understanding of what's real in our world. And it's also, I would suggest, how you can form your understanding of what's real in the spiritual realm as well. In one of the next segments on this, I do Is There a Supernatural Being? Can He Walk and Talk? And I'll make the case that you're not a self-caused being. You haven't determined your existence. You have no control over whether you exist or not exist. And even your death, unless you're trying to commit suicide, you can't say, I'm not going to die. It happens. You say, I'm going to die today. No, that doesn't happen unless you actually take other steps. You just can't cause it by your thought. You're not a self-caused being. You have to be caused. And we start looking at the different evidence for it, and eventually it points to a creator, a self-caused thing that's always existed. Universe is not eternal. You can prove that pretty easily. We'll do that in future weeks, maybe, if you behave yourself. So I want to get to E, and that says a creator with the power to create would probably have the power to communicate. What do you think? If you can kind of cause this world to exist, if you can make it, you can probably say things about it. Would it be logical to think, more reasonable to think than not, that the creator with the power to create would have the power to communicate? Yeah, I guess so. Because by what basis would you say he doesn't have it? And then if he can communicate, would he also have the power to preserve that communication and do it in such a way that his creatures could understand what he was going to say? Well, yeah, if he's got power, he can do what he wants with it, and that probably fit into that power, because if I, as a human being, it's more limited and finite, can do such things, I would assume that whatever I came from could do it as well. All right. The question then arises, well, would he communicate? So here I am in this room. I see babies come in, old guys jump out, and I'm thinking, okay, what's the purpose for all this? And if someone could come and give me a purpose, it would be a universal purpose for why I'm in existence, would he do such a thing? It's funny, when I was going through this stuff like 3 decades or so ago, I was an engineer and a neurobio major, and I was just fascinated by what went on inside me. I could see order, I could see pattern, I could see purpose for every little thing under my skin. And for my physics courses that I had, I knew that there was order, purpose, and pattern for everything in the outside world. And there I was in between all this order, purpose, and I was just in chaos. And I'm thinking, this doesn't fit. If there's order, purpose, and pattern to everything around me and everything within me, I wonder if there might be a purpose for me. And I also knew that people tend to kill themselves when they don't have any purpose. You know, when I was in college, I was at about that state. And I started thinking, yeah, I wonder if there's a purpose for existence. Why are we here? Why does this happen? And if there was a purpose for my existence, would the Creator tell me what that purpose was? And the answer to that question was, yeah, it's probably more reasonable to think he would tell you than not tell you. And that kind of started me on a search for what God had communicated. John 1:17 says, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. And he gives us grace, manyfold, manifold thing, and he gives us truth. He tells us reality. Earlier in those verses, I think it's 14, he says, no one's seen God, but Jesus has it. He explains him to us. So One more thing I want to touch on before I wrap some of this up and open for questions is Jesus said to the apostles in John 16:13. By the way, Jesus talks more about truth. I mean, John talks more about truth than any other writers. Jesus said in the upper room, the night before he died, he said, when the Spirit of truth comes, he will guide you into all truth. And Paul says in 1 Corinthians 2:10, you know, God's given us revelation, we have the mind of Christ and all this other stuff. What people don't tend to realize is that was the apostles, those were the miracle workers. They were people whose understanding of truth was authenticated by the supernatural. That's not something that we all have, because actually none of us have this. We get our truth not because God suddenly gives us truth, but he reveals it in his word. A real quick way to prove this is if you talk to another Christian, do you have exactly the same understanding of the truth? Obviously, you've never been in the beginning of a Bible study when there are, you know, six people and six different understandings of what a passage means. And then hopefully by the end of the study, it narrows down to an agreement on this is kind of what is most reasonable to believe. My definition of truth that I use when I teach my history classes, and it works in science and it works in life, is under Roman numeral 1F, that which best explains all the facts. You come across a lot of theories that don't quite explain all the facts. For instance, you've all heard of the Big Bang Theory. Did we see the Big Bang? Is it observable, repeatable, in a controlled environment? No, you can't repeat that. Though Stephen Hawking thinks you can. You have the oscillating universe. It's like it expands, it expands, it expands, it expands, and then it contracts, contracts, contracts. Excuse me, Dr. Hawking, when was the last time we saw the universe contract? Well, it's kind of like a theory, Weizsäcker. it's a theory. And isn't it true that as things progress, the energy level goes less and less, and the gravitational pulls between particles becomes less and less, and the likelihood of it actually contracting becomes less and less, approaching zero? Wise guy. So, you know, it's a theory, but it doesn't really explain the facts. You've all heard of black holes, right? It might be a decent theory. Has anybody ever seen a black hole? A black hole is defined as something by which light never escapes. In order for us to see it, light has to escape. So if light doesn't escape, it's really hard to see it. We kind of see the effects and we say, well, that's probably a black hole and there's something going on there. They're kind of theories. But let's say we have facts that don't fit our theories. What do we do with those? Well, we obviously put them under the rug and don't deal with them. History, there's huge theories on everything. And there's facts that contradict most of the theories. And as I read studies and textbooks and everything, I realize, oh, they just conveniently left out these facts. When we get to carbon dating, the pieces of carbon dating, the dates that come back that don't fit the theory are tossed. Everybody in the science community knows that. Well, it's not that accurate, but, you know, it gets presented to the public as being completely, totally accurate. So when I'm looking for truth, I'm looking for what best explains all the facts. It's possible that there might be some information that causes me to change my understanding of the truth. It's not going to change the truth. But how do I know what the truth is? I take the facts, I build them together, I say, does this make sense? Well, it explains this, this, and this. Oh, yeah, but it doesn't work on that. So maybe I need to rechange it. You don't get this monolithic block of stone. This is the truth. Actually, there is such a thing, but we don't get it. We get pieces and we put them together. In the scriptures, we have records of God's revelation. It's not, he doesn't give us a philosophical treatise. He gives us pieces and we put it together. In my Western Civ course, we look at this unique thing called Western Civ, which is a product of largely the Judeo-Christian ethic. It was advanced by the Greeks and perfected by the Romans. Those are the three basic civilizations that give us Western Civ. From the Hebrews and the Christians, we get this idea of revelation. God coming into the room from the ceiling or the walls or back through the window or whatever you want and saying, this is the way it is. Revelation. And that totally changed life on this planet. It demystified the universe. It gave us personal rights, property rights. All this wonderful stuff comes about from the Jewish scriptures and continued in the Christian scriptures. And then our friends, the Greeks, give us reason, logical consistency. Sometimes the revelation is a little difficult to understand, but it should, if it's true, stand the scrutiny of reason. It's not a relative thing. It's an absolute there, and reason helps us find it. And our friends, the Romans. The Romans were always interested, does it work? I want it to work. Very pragmatic people. The Greeks had this idea of how government should be, but they never really progressed very far with it. The Romans, they made it work, okay? All right, to get you guys to live in harmony with us, we're going to give you citizenship. And the Greeks just said, oh no, you can't give barbarians citizenship. Romans says, it works, we'll give it to them. We've got to keep these plebs from uprising. Okay, we'll give some laws, keep them. But commoners have laws? Well, it works. So the Romans were always interested in it working. And what I found as I started going through and I looked at different world religions and I actually do a comparative civ course and look at the different things is I judge them on the basis of revelation, reason, and reality. Does it give accurate understanding of what the world's all about? Is it logically consistent? And does it work? You know, emperor worship works really well if you have an emperor. You know, how do you do emperor worship in Puerto Rico? I mean, they don't have an emperor there. What do you do? So you want something that kind of is going to work across time and culture. And when I understand truth, I understand it to fit this paradigm. It's based on revelation. That's supernaturally authenticated. A little piece in there that's nice. It's reason. It's logically consistent. It's not going to be contradictory. And it's going to work. And that's one of the wonderful things about Christianity. It works across time. It works across culture. It took over the Roman Empire. And it can take over your life if you use it appropriately. I'm not going to cover the stuff down below unless we run out of good questions. But let me just draw your attention to it. Truth is the basis of a relationship with God. If you don't have the truth, you don't have the relationship with God. That relationship doesn't even develop through sanctification unless you got truth. Two of my favorite verses are in here. The first one, under Roman numeral 3, first line down, is Jesus spoke, speaking these words, many believed in him. They heard his revelation, they believed it. Then he said to those Jews who believed him, if you abide or continue or remain in my word, you are my disciples indeed. And the result of that is that you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. The person whose life is built on truth will eventually become free because of the sanctification process. And if you want to know if you're free or not, Jesus goes on a little bit later to say anybody who commits sin is a slave of sin. They're not free. The Jews were giving him an argument. They even believed in him, but they're giving an argument that they've never been enslaved. And he said, you commit sin, you're a slave of sin. And Paul gives us a whole chapter in Romans 6 about that. My other favorite verse is actually right above it. Sanctify them with your truth, said Jesus. One of the last parts of the prayer just before he left the disciples at the Last Supper. And he says, thy word is truth. And he says, I sanctify myself that they might be sanctified by your truth. Truth is vital for the Christian life. It's vital for holiness. It's vital for, which is vital for a relationship with God. It's also the basis of your ministry. And under Roman numeral 4, just a little blurb that you can look at later, is all kinds of people who believe the truth, but then actually don't progress in it. They don't obey it. They suppress it. They exchange it. They stray from it. They wander from it. They do all kinds of things. And part of ministry is moving them back towards it. We'll come back to that at the end if we have time. So, questions on the stuff up in Roman numeral 1? Yeah, Steve?
A more general question. So, when you're talking to people like Tom or Michael Lane, what do you think about it? Why am I here? Why did we cause this? Is this true or not? And there's other types of people who, I don't even know about truth. Life works for me, it's great, and that you really don't think about stuff like that, that's sort of ethereal stuff. How do you
engage folks? I don't talk to people like that. I only talk to Tom and Michael. And Chet. Before I give my answer, anybody have any suggestions? Yeah, Gary?
Well, just from my own experience, living life as a believer, but not really knowing the whole truth, but what God really wanted for me, life in the end just didn't work for me. So, house on a very solid foundation, when things get difficult, then it will be challenging. So. people say that, you might start thinking, well, you ever experienced difficulties, and then did your kind of life philosophy work when you come out of that, whatever, the things, because you have your own experience for either kind of people that might have questions or whatever.
Yeah, the power of a witness of a life, that this is how it works, is pretty attractive. Another one back?
Yeah, I just pray that something comes up that they can't deal with on their own.
Something comes up that they can't handle
on their own.
Yeah, frequently, like when a loved one dies or, you know, someone loses their job, they start thinking, well, what's going on? Or they get their job and they get their stuff and then they said, this doesn't work, and they start getting into escapism. Yeah, that happens. Other thoughts? Yeah?
I think a Corinne was mentioning how she shared with her friend about how a relationship with God can provide that contentment. I think finding areas, everyone has an area because their needs are not being met because they have infinite needs and they're trying to meet them in finite ways. So talking to people and trying to figure out what those needs are and showing how God can meet those needs.
Yeah. Yeah, so I was just thinking about that. You work your way backwards. Like, if here's this immediate need and then, oh, well, did you know actually God has talked about other things relative to your life? Oh, and then actually he has a purpose for you. And, you know, it's like kind of going the other direction.
Right, there's a series I did on reasonable evangelism way back when, not the one a couple falls ago where I just did the evolution stuff, but a couple years before that, called Reasonable Evangelism, where part of the task is to authenticate the truth, to show that the truth meets needs in their life. You find God made us to be needy and to need him. We try to stuff it with all these other things. So to find something where it's contentment and show how God has really designed himself to meet that need, not any of the externals, because you keep trying to fill the God-shaped vacuum with things that are not God. So, yeah, that's a really great way to... And in times of need, as Laura mentioned, people have questions or, you know, why do this? What's the point? And I actually always try to get people to think, well, what's going to happen in the end? You know, all business guys, you plan for what's going to happen in the future. What about your life? What's going to happen? What happens at the end of it? What happens if you've climbed a ladder of success and found out that it's leaning against the wrong building? What are you going to do then? It's too late. So don't you kind of want to figure out now how God intended life? And I admit that in our environment, there are lots of people who are just gung-ho going for all the gusto because there's a lot of gusto around. But somewhere along the line, it kind of doesn't satisfy, or they run into something that's bigger than them, or they got needs that aren't being met by their power and job. Well, how do you know that?
Actually, a good response to that is say, well, if I'm right, after you're gone, you're going to spend eternity suffering. If I'm wrong, then it doesn't really matter. So given that the chance at stake, you really might lose out big time. Isn't it worth it just to spend a few hours figuring out if it might be true or not?
That's Pascal's wager. Yeah.
Pascal's wager. Yeah, that's... Yeah, Michael.
On the flip side of what Mr. Min said, people like me and Tom can sometimes get so interested in these questions. It happens. It's easy for us to think about them a lot. It's what consumes our thought. But what works for us has more of a philosophical meaning and a psycho-emotional meaning. Whereas what works for someone who's just doing it and kind of going for it, they have something that we don't. Which is, like, we can accept truths that are really unreasonable and don't work in a physical way. But that's okay for us. But they have a truth that if it doesn't work for them in an actual life, then they can't believe it. Whereas that's easier for us to do. Like, we can have the same kind of problem.
For those of you on the tape, the door just opened and a person came through and hands went out the window. Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Bible is true. The Bible
Well, eventually what these seven questions do is they help you understand the concept of truth. Then a creator, it's more reasonable to believe in a creator than not. Otherwise, you're believing things just popped into being, existence. Oops, there goes another one. Then it moves to the communication. You can walk, act in history, and talk. And it's more reasonable to believe that we have this accurate record than not. And then you start looking at what that record actually says and comparing Christianity to other things. In the meantime, you do this little thing, how can a good God allow suffering? And that is a wonderful topic that everyone I have talked to in New York seriously about it brings that one up because they have suffering. And they said, you know, your Bible says that God is loving and good and all-powerful. And if he was loving, good, and all-powerful, he would do something about this evil that exists in our world. And I said, well, you mean the election? No. And then it's... there's a purpose, and I've done some stuff on how can God allow evil for that. There's a plan for it. God reveals that. It's more reasonable to believe that that's going to happen than something else happens. So you move people towards that. It's a progression. Other questions or thoughts? Yeah, John.
The other thought, maybe the complement of what Steve was saying is, you know, there's a content that we know that needs to be communicated, but there's also a timing issue. So if you have a relationship and it's on a very superficial level, it's because things are dynamic and things change, it's possible that person might move to a needy stage, as other people were saying. And the ability to know when that timing is and being available, I think, is the other aspect of it.
Yeah, this is all that reasonable evangelism stuff. It develops a relationship. It's nurtured. I think you just heard the testimonies earlier of the people that were, because they built the relationships, they had it into the people's lives. One of my favorite techniques to get under a person's skin on this subject is to just say, you know, have them come to the awareness, you're being unreasonable. What? I'm not being unreasonable. Oh, yeah, you are. Okay. And just plant that seed of, like, because some people like to have things figured out. You know, they want to be competent in this world. And, well, boy, shame you're missing the boat on that one. And just to kind of plant some seeds, not obviously with that nonverbal communication, but that is the idea. Someone else had a question?
Oh, I was just thinking that if my colleagues were sitting here, some of them, they would say, this is all fine, but it's a very ethnocentric Western view, and that the world is not just made up of Western.
Right, they would definitely say that. So I would ask them if they've actually studied other cultures.
Yes, they would say yes and give you chapters.
Oh, well then they should have them talk with me. Because if you look at the other cultures, how come, you know, they are as they are? And we have what we have. And why do people want... I mean, yes, it is an ethnocentric thing. Christianity works in any culture. It's not just a Western thing. It works in every single culture that it goes into.
I guess what I was wondering is, do Eastern religions show the same combination of revelation, reason, and reality, or is that unique?
If you look at the textual basis of any other religion, it's incredibly bogus. It's based on folklores that are just bizarre. So I cannot imagine anyone saying, I studied this, and they have a scriptures that make sense. Scriptures that are rooted in reality, scriptures that are verifiable, and scriptures that are logically consistent. Because every single one that I've read is incredibly flawed, incredibly. Some of them are just, yeah, it's like reading Disney. So for a person to say, oh, I've studied it, you haven't studied it. That's a lie. You know, you're saying that. Let me see your text. What you study? It doesn't work. And then you look at how the civilizations developed. It's just, and what the net result is. For most civilizations, religion was the prerogative of the elite. The common man had nothing. For most civilizations, even the elite had to serve the deity in return for being put in power. Relationship with God doesn't exist. There's one of the seven questions, and it's actually already on our truth-based site, just comparing the major world religions. And just look at where they came from, what the purpose of man is, where you're headed. There's no comparison between them and Christianity. So even if they haven't read a text on comparative sieves, just look at the products of those sieves, and you can't say that they are at all comparable. There's another question back there. Vince.
So related. Bill, I mean, I think a lot of people would say, oh, yeah, I believe in a God, a creator, I can get a sense of it, but they won't go with you in terms of he communicated through scripture. So any thoughts on making that version?
Yeah, that's the next piece. Once you buy into the creator, he has the power to communicate. Is it reasonable to believe that he would or wouldn't? Let's go look at the communication. So there's actually, all these are already on TruthBase from when I did sermons on them a while ago. But you just compare the authenticity, reliability, impact, and influence of the scriptures. And it's like this, nothing comparable to them.
That's a comparison basis, but I think people would, they don't pray the scripture. They're just saying, oh, I pray and he tells me something.
Right, so how do you know that that's true? How do you know it's God answering your prayer? There are other spirit beings out there. How do you know what's going on? The only way you as a finite being can know the infinite is if the infinite has revealed it. Otherwise, you're just making stuff up or possibly subject to evil being influence. So eventually, this is top of another subject, is you build a case for the revelation. And I just actually put some of the foundation in here that he would have the power to communicate. Then you ask, is it more reasonable? And then you look at the reality. How do you explain Christianity taking over the Roman Empire by 300 AD when they were still being used for candles and cat food up until 313 AD? How do you explain that? How do you explain the rapid rise and influence of Christianity all over the world? And you can explain its demise because people don't follow it. So there's this piece. See, to go back to people's needs, people basically need, one of the fundamental needs is they need worth validation in order to be able to function correctly in relationships. God offers that. It's the only source for it. When I do Alexander the Great and Caesar Augustus and Napoleon, these guys achieved everything and their relationships were horrible and their sense of worth and value was terrible and you had to always get it at the expense of someone else, just like your coworkers who aren't as accomplished. And only God meets that need. They have these needs that God meets, and you're saying, if you don't have God meeting those needs, you're going to have to get them at the expense of others, and that does ruinous things to interpersonal relationships.
One interesting analogy to use with people who want to argue about relativism as opposed to absolute truth is when people get on an airplane, do they want to have a pilot that has an absolute way of taking the plane off and landing it, or do they want to, are they equally comfortable with the pilot who thinks you can push the stick down as opposed to up when you want to land and take off? So I think everybody in this world demands a certain absolute way of doing things.
Same narrow-mindedness is a good thing.
With medicines or whatever, there are some absolutes that if they're not followed, it's catastrophic. An airplane would be a prime example.
I was having one of these conversations with my dentist. And about concepts or conclusions and stuff like that. No, that's not what we're. And it's basically, I don't want the dentist to turn on their drill and say, "Oh, let's just put this in your mouth and whirl it around and see what happens." I want them to have a focus, a purpose. It's like the specific spot of the tooth that you have to touch with that, and nothing else. It's like you really want the narrow focus because that's what the reality is. Yeah, Michael.
That kind of idea really only works if there's no interplay between the immaterial and the material. Like, our material existence has absolute universal implications. Like, when we physically die, we materially, immaterially have a change. So, like, at first I thought that analogy doesn't really work because they're talking about material things, they're talking about immaterial things. Maybe the way to talk about it is like, well, religions, they can't all be to the same place because they talk about physical things having immaterial impacts. Like, if it was all like, let's think these things and what it will result in is an immaterial thing. But Christianity says this, if we believe these things, we have a material physical body with bodily resurrection. There's a place called heaven.
Right, and the only way we know that is if it's been authenticated by a spokesman from the other side. So that kind of fits. So the Santa, I miss Santa. That's in the title. Let me just give you this last little piece on Santa as experience determining truth. Kids all around the United States, at least, some other parts of the world, go to a mall, tell Santa they want a toy, you know, a doll or a train or whatever, and they go to sleep Christmas Eve, they leave out a carrot for Santa's reindeer, milk and cookies, and the next morning, the milk and cookies, and, you know, the carrot has a bite out of it, the milk and cookies are gone, and there's the toy they asked for under the tree. That's their experience. How can you argue with it? And then they go to school and they check with all their friends and the same thing happened. It must be true. And that's the way most people think. Because I experienced it and somebody else knew. You know, even my experience, I'm doing okay just as I am. And other people I know, we're not doing great, but we're doing okay. Therefore, it must be right. But obviously, that's a fairy tale. It doesn't exist. And unfortunately, that also happens once you get into the Christian realm. People don't disabuse themselves of that fallacy. All right, our food's here, so it's time to end, and let me pray, and then we'll eat. Father, thank you that you are truth. Thank you that you have communicated that to us in such a way that we can understand. Thank you that you sent your Son, who said, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life. Thank you that we've experienced that in our lives, and we can share it with others. Father, I pray you would help us be good stewards of your truth, be able to make a reasonable explanation for the hope that's in us. I pray that you'd use us in the lives of others. I pray we'd be sensitive to having conversations, praying for them, and see you helping us in the midst of them. Thank you for our fellowship. Thank you for our food. We pray you bless our time in Christ's name. Amen.